The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
That are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
It's corrupt!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. But whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game. Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
You're listening to the premiere of Polarity One's new beat, his new disc, being broadcast here on News Dissector Radio on Progressive Radio Network exclusively. Listen and learn. Happening in America. You're hearing it here. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector on News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network .com. You can call us and share your thoughts on what we're talking about today on 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. With us in the studio, Kat Waters, Sue Min, and you'll surely also meet a producer, filmmaker from China who's joining us in the second half, Joanne Chung. So that's part of the lineup today, but the focus, the featured element of our program today is something that happened 2 years ago in Haiti, not far from the shores of the United States, that devastating earthquake. Billions of dollars was sent to help the people of Haiti. Only a handful of that money actually seems to have reached them. We're going to hear more. We're going to talk to actually people who are very knowledgeable about Haiti, Michelle Mitchell. Michelle is the producer of Haiti, Where Did the Money Go?, premiering this month on PBS stations nationwide. Michelle is in Haiti right now, in the airport in Port-au-Prince, and we're hoping to reach her once she gets through security. So she'll be joining us from Haiti and giving us a direct report. Also joining us this morning, Lisa Davis, the director or one of the leaders of MADRE, an organization that fights for the rights of women and has issued a new report about sexual favors being expected from women and young girls in Haiti in order to get food, a dramatic expose of what's really happening there, and Lisa will tell us more about it. Also, joining us is from the Center for Economic and Political Relations, policy research, is Mark Weisbrod. He's the co-author of a chapter in the new book, Tectonic Shifts, Haiti Since the Earthquake. And he's going to give us some of the context of what's happening there. So a report from Haiti, a political analyst, a human rights activist, all talking about what's happening there. You'll notice that Haiti has sort of dropped off the news here in America. During the earthquake, it was, on constantly. There were the stories of the dramatic rescues of people, largely by Americans, from buildings where they were, basically barely, alive. And that was the drama of the moment. But after all of that ended, American networks pulled out, and the reality of Haiti went on. In fact, what's very interesting, given that Joanne is in the studio with us, is that the first country to send relief To Haiti was not the United States, which is the closest, but China. China had a plane ready to go because of the earthquake that took place in China, of people with earthquake dogs and trained personnel, and they got to Haiti before anyone else. They landed before the United States took over the airport and raced into Port-au-Prince to help people. So this was an example of the incredible international solidarity that took place in Haiti, of people trying to help. And as it turns out, the country that did the most for Haiti is not the United States, I must say, in an ashamed way, but Cuba. Cuba sent doctors. Cuba sent medical students. Cuba sent all kinds of direct assistance. Cuba, a relatively poor country. The United States, an extremely rich country. And yet Cuba, to some degree Venezuela, did more for Haiti than the United States. The UN is there, and their record has been blemished as well, because the UN is really being blamed for the cholera epidemic that's taken place in Haiti since the earthquake. So Haiti remains a disaster. The disaster is not over there, and we're hoping to get our guests on the line very soon to share their views. And we're going to go to one right now. Who is this? Hi, welcome. Hello. Hi. Okay, let's go. Lisa, how are you? Good morning. How are you? And thank you for joining us here on News Dissector Radio. Lisa Davis with MADRE, a human rights organization that's been focusing on Haiti, focusing on the conditions of women and children in Haiti, and also Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He is someone who's been following and tracking developments there and in Latin America, and we're pleased to have them both with us. We'll be joined in the not too distant future by Michelle Mitchell. Michelle is a producer of Haiti, Where Did the Money Go?, which is a film that's going to be shown on PBS later this month. She's in Haiti. She's in Port-au-Prince. She's in the airport. We're hoping we'll be able to make a connection with her. She's agreed to come on the program. But let's if we can, start with you, Mark. You've been tracking this in terms of the big picture. What is actually happened in Haiti since this earthquake?
Well, unfortunately, not enough. I mean, there was some relief efforts, and those were important, have been important. But you still have, half a million people in camps, and some don't even have tents. Some don't have access to clean water. The ones with tents, of course, are not adequate either. You have another rainy season that's going to come up in a few months, and hurricanes, too. You have cholera, which is worse. I mean, that's actually not a human, that's a man-made disaster. I mean, that was brought there by the United Nations.
How so?
Well, some troops from, looks like Nepal, UN troops dumped their human waste in one of the country's main water supplies. There's been several scientific studies already now published by the Center for Disease Control, the New England Journal of Medicine, the UN study itself, another one of 15 scientists this August that actually got the samples of the bacteria from Nepal and matched it. It matched pretty much perfectly with what you have in Haiti. And so everyone knows that they did it, and the UN is still denying it and trying to avoid responsibility for it.
200 Haitians a month are coming down with cholera. 200, 25,000 people have become sick as a result of this.
So this is actually, it's much more than
that. Go ahead.
500,000 have become sick, and 7,000 have died. More than 7,000 have died. More than 500,000 have become sick. Last summer the rates were being infected at 50,000 a month. And that's come down now because it's dry season, but when the rainy season starts again, it'll get worse. And this is something that was gross negligence. To me, it's no different from what happened in Bhopal in India 35 years ago. I mean, they didn't do it on purpose either, but they had every reason to know that they were bringing people from an area with cholera to a country that never had it before, okay? And, I mean, Haiti's never, in the last 100 years at least, they haven't had cholera. And, you know, a country with really horrible water treatment and sanitation facilities. So this was a huge risk, and they should have either not brought troops from any country like that, or been really careful about not getting that bacteria in the river.
Just the last point on this. You've written that the UN's defense that the weakness of Haiti's health and water infrastructure relieves it of responsibility would be laughed out of court if the UN ever let itself be brought before an independent tribunal. Lisa, you've been listening to all of this. You're a human rights activist. You've been tracking what's happening in Haiti. You've been working with women's movements in Haiti and organizations that are trying to fight for social and economic justice for people there. What's the situation through your eyes?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. As an attorney, we've been trying to bring cases in the international community against those who are responsible and not willing to deal with the issues of both sexual violence and sexual exploitation. And what we have seen is that, of course, anywhere in the world that there is disaster or conflict, you always see an increase in vulnerabilities such as in crimes such as sexual violence or sexual exploitation. So Haiti is certainly no exception, and it's not unique in that way. And what we found right after the earthquake was a dramatic increase in sexual violence and sexual exploitation. And as the aid communities are starting to leave Haiti, and a lot of the relief is packing up and getting ready to go, we've seen that the issue of sexual exploitation is getting even worse, that women and children, primarily youth, are turning to survival sex as a form of getting their needs met.
So survival we're talking about sex.
Trading, survival sex. So we're talking about trading sex for a meal, for a tarp, for a blanket, for a place to stay, for what would be the equivalent of a few U.S. dollars. And this is because of the economic desperation. And we have to remember that there's still 500,000 people living in displacement camps.
And those people in those camps, the camps were thrown together often without any security and or inadequate security, certainly.
That's absolutely true. I mean, camps range from anywhere from 200 people to 5,000 people, and without any sort of lighting or security. Residents describe it as being so dark that they can't even see their feet at night when they walk, and it is just the most prime conditions for creating robbery and sexual violence and all kinds of issues that go with impunity. And although there's been some progress made, the community, the international community, UN, has been able to respond to some of these demands, especially after we had filed a court case with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And they did provide some security and lighting in some of the camps. Certainly most of the camps still don't have it or don't have it at an adequate level. And so these crimes continue to persist.
Let's just put this in a context, because this was like a tremendous crisis. If you remember President Obama's statements, Michelle Obama raising money for the American Red Cross, every charity raising money for Haiti around the clock, all this focus on all the great work that the United States was doing. And yet, you know, here we are 2 years later. And people are asking, where did the money go? Why didn't the people of Haiti, who had the deepest needs, not seem to receive very much help? And, you know, this is a question that really puts the United States' efforts there to shame. This is a massive failure. And, in fact, at the time when this happened, I was being interviewed on RT, Russia Today, about the announcement that the U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, rather, would take over the airport in Port-au-Prince. And they did so, and they prevented other planes, relief planes, like for Medicine Without Frontiers, from even landing there to bring help because they were securing the airport. And everybody knows that in a disaster like this, help has to be happening immediately. When you have people in urgent need, they can't wait for people to make assessments and, you know, go through a whole rigmarole. They have to act immediately. And the U.S. was acting, but acting to defend itself, setting up the airport, putting troops there to the force protection and all the rest of it. And the aid was not getting out into the city of Port-au-Prince and not getting to the people. And so that was the first disgrace and mistake of all this, and it seems to have been compounded. Am I wrong?
Actually, you're totally right. I mean, certainly some of those things were needed, but you're right. There has to be always a two-pronged approach when disaster hits. One has to be preparing for the long-term needs in terms of assessments for building housing, but there also has to be the immediate needs that are met, passing out wind-up flashlights, passing out whistles, getting security in place, getting clean water in place. All the things that we should know and we should have learned from the many post-conflict and disaster situations that we have given aid to. Part of the problem with the U.S. aid is that institutions such as USAID, for example, actually can't give money to the U.S. to the Haitian government or Haitian organizations because of a clause in the Dole Amendment that passed some years ago. But besides that, what
they can
we
only
found
give money to American agencies, correct?
They can only give money to American agencies. And what we've found is that USAID is not the only one to fall under this trap. The vast majority of donor money has gone not to the Haitian government and not to local Haitian organizations, but to international organizations that oftentimes will hire maybe some people at lower levels to do lower-level jobs in country, but really bring in their own people out of country. And when those jobs are done or those jobs are up, they leave, and those jobs leave with them.
You know, it's sort of an NGO paradise in Haiti. You know, all these NGOs, uncoordinated, not working together in many instances. Some stellar examples of people who have been helping for many years in Haiti, like Dr. Paul Farmer and his Partners in Health organization, people, who have really worked very hard to, you know, help and empower people there. But, you know, rather than a massive jobs program, which would give the people there some money that they desperately need to buy food and to get resources, the money has gone to these outsiders who need fancy cars to get around in and all the rest of it. And so the resources, you know, don't really go to the people who are in the most desperate situations, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. That's why organizations like Madre, they model their aid relief efforts after how Partners in Health does theirs, whereas Partners in Health partners with a local organization, Zomni La Fonte. Madre does the same thing. We partner with Copa Vive, a grassroots Haitian women's organization who were living and working in the camps. We just got them enough money to reopen a women's center. They're still working and doing outreach in the camps, reaching out to youth and to orphans that are engaged in survival sex, reaching out to women and children that are vulnerable, and educating men's groups, and doing the kind of work that really only the grassroots women's groups that are operating on ground can really do. International relief groups can't really reach these populations. They oftentimes don't speak the language, they don't know the culture, they're not from Haiti, and they're not going to really reach the groups that need the help. And if we really want to look at both doing immediate needs and long-term needs, we need to focus on building up the strength and capacity of Haitian organizations that both can reach the immediate needs and are going to be there in the long term.
I mean, there has been some good media coverage. You know, CNN certainly did a lot at the very beginning. Al Jazeera did some excellent documentaries from Haiti. But by and large, you know, this is a sort of example of, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. You know, the media maybe checked in on the six-month anniversary, on the one-year anniversary, but now, you know, with the primaries going on and, you know, situation with Iran heating up, Haiti has almost got no attention whatsoever. And the people there, I think, have every right to be extremely cynical about American intentions. Mark, you know, what do you think? You know, there's another aspect to this. You know, you study political policy. The president, the elected president of Haiti, had been deposed by the Bush administration, sent to Africa, and then managed to get to South Africa, where his life was basically saved. I'm talking about Mr. Aristide. And then he wasn't allowed to run for office again. And now we have a new president, a musician named Martelly, who seems to want to just rebuild the Haitian army, isn't really speaking out in terms of the needs of the Haitian people.
Well, I mean, that's part of the huge problem. If you look at why Haiti is a mess today, I mean, they had chances to rebuild the country when President Aristide was first elected in 1990, and then he was overthrown in a military coup in 1991, and that was done by people who were actually paid, according to the New York Times, by the CIA. And then in 2004, as you mentioned, they overthrew him again. after ruining the economy and just withholding all international aid for 4 years in order to get rid of him. And this one they did in broad daylight. They don't, and if you look at the WikiLeaks cables, you know, you might wonder why the United States goes through all this trouble. I mean, you know, more recently, as you hinted at, they intervened in the OAS in the end of 2010 and into 2011 to reverse the results of the November elections there. November of 2010. And so you have a situation where they don't want independent government. They don't want Haitians to be able to elect their own government. The largest political party, the most popular political party in the country, was excluded from the last election.
That's La Balasse, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's what you're seeing also in the realm of aid. You don't have Haitians having a voice in how the aid is used, with the exception of, you know, NGOs, as was already mentioned, like Madre or Partners in Health, you know, where they really do work with Haitians and try to not replace the government, but to actually help build the capacity of the country. And, you know, that's one of the things that's really going to have to change.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's infuriating about all of this, you know, is first of all how consistent it's been through American history. Back, you know, 1916, American Marines landing in Haiti. Basically, they were in Haiti for, what, 20 years, 26 years, dominating Haiti. Then we imposed one dictator after another. Aristide wins with a popular vote. We undermine him. Even when Aristide went back to Haiti, which is a fascinating story to me, because Bill Clinton forced the, you know, expulsion of the military rule there that was actually committing all these human rights abuses against Haitians. They were worried that more and more Haitians would want to come to America. They didn't want them here, basically. Now you have Haitians really fleeing to Brazil to find jobs in Latin America because they're not allowed in the United States, the land of the free and home of the brave. And yet, in all of this, the lessons here aren't clear, and it's been true in the Bush administration and the Obama administration. Republicans and Democrats seem to have been consistently against, you know, the self-determination rights of the Haitian people. And this is really why people talk about imperialism in the war world. In other words, that the system of American intervention is not just a political partisan effort, but seems to be consistent in terms of whoever is in power. They tend to treat people in other countries the same way. The Chinese have a word for it. They call it hegemony, or, you know, a way in which the American government basically tries to dominate political discourse in other countries and orders other people, tells them what to do and what not to do. And, you know, it's very upsetting, needless to say. This is the weekend coming up of the Martin Luther King, you know, a birthday. Martin Luther King was an outspoken advocate for the rights of people all over the world. He was against war. He was against imperialism. He was for social and political rights for all people. They are going to be commemorating Dr. King. There's a big Occupy Wall Street action. Do you know about it, what's happening?
Yeah, this Sunday at, I believe it's 6:30, they're going to be meeting at Riverside Church.
Riverside Church is where Dr. King gave his famous anti-war speech against the Vietnam War and was criticized roundly by so many people. We've been having some problems reaching Haiti. Michelle Mitchell, the producer of Where Did the Money Go, who is supposed to be with us, apparently is hard to find because she's trapped in the airport there where she may not be able to use her phone. She says that half of all U.S. households donated over $1.4 billion to major charities specifically for relief. But after hundreds of millions have been spent, there are still over a half a million people living in squalid conditions. There are fewer working latrines today, not to mention fewer latrines, no water delivery, malnutrition on the rise, and the Haitians living in these tent cities are in a kind of purgatory. They have no idea when they are getting out or even if things will ever go and become any better. And so if Michelle can't join us, at least you can watch her program on public television, Where Did the Money Go? Certainly important, and maybe when she comes back from Haiti, we can have her give us a little update on what's happening there. Just Mark and Lisa, would you like to just sum up your sense of where we are in the second anniversary of the earthquake?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. We'll let Lisa wrap it up.
Well, I think the biggest things we discussed, that the reconstruction effort has been grossly inadequate. They didn't allocate enough money to begin with. The estimates were $10 to $14 billion, what they needed to reconstruct the country. The government's pledged about $5 billion. They've dispersed, according to official figures, about half of that, but even that is less, is more than they actually spent, because disbursement just means it goes to some organization, doesn't necessarily get spent on the ground. And so it's been grossly inadequate. It hasn't met the basic needs of Haitians, especially in the case of housing for people displaced by the earthquake. And I think the other big thing going forward is going to be holding the UN accountable for bringing cholera to the country. I don't think any country in the world you can think of, or any certainly in this hemisphere, where someone could bring a deadly disease to a country like that, kill that many people, and not even have to take responsibility for it. So I think those are things, two things going forward, that are going to have to be dealt with.
Well, Mark Weisbrot of the, you know, of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, author of a chapter in the new book, Tectonic Shifts, Haiti Since the Earthquake. Thank you so much for joining us. Final word now to Lisa Davis of MADRE, attorney with MADRE, a human rights group that's been working tirelessly to try to help the people of Haiti.
Well, we saw that the earthquake left the country in a shambles, with over 1 million people left homeless and infrastructure devastated. And 2 years later, we see that there has been some improvement, but certainly not enough. And as we look at all of the aid money that has been pledged to Haiti, we have to keep to our commitment to push donor states and the international community to make sure that aid money gets into the hands of the Haitian people, so that it goes to Haitian organization, it goes to the Haitian government, and that we start rebuilding the capacity of Haiti so that it can truly meet the needs of its people and not look at Haiti as an economic opportunity to produce cheap exports to international countries of interest. And as we look at Haiti, we realize that Haiti is at a real crossroads, and this is the time when we can make a difference, and we have a choice. We can push to make sure that a rights-based approach is taken, that we are addressing the human rights needs of the people of Haiti and their capacity, or we can do politics as usual, looking at doing what's economically of interest to the international community and not to the people of Haiti.
Thank you, Lisa Davis. Thank you, MADRE, for all your work. Thank you, Mark, for your work. Sorry we couldn't bring you to Haiti as we had hoped to do, but we are exploring this. We will come back to this subject. Here's part of that song again by Hilarity One, Occupy This.
Of the United States of Credit. One nation under debt, with bankruptcies, late fees, and high interest for all.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. borrowing and debt. In debt, we trust.
It's kind of hard to serve the master and MasterCard.
I just need your signature right here, please.
The gospel of shopping. The gospel of buying things.
Our society has been really set up to keep us struggling and not give us relief.
In debt, we trust.
The national savings rate.
Well, that's some of the excerpts from my film, In Debt We Trust. Problems haven't gone away since I made that film in 2006. It sort of predicted the financial crisis. We returned to it because, of course, the global economy has since gone into, into the crapper. The problems of financial ization, the problems of foreclosure, of joblessness, of unemployment have grown, and at the same time, the Chinese economy has done a lot better, but it also is showing signs of problems because we're all connected to each other through globalization. What happens here today is going to affect somebody somewhere else, in the same way that AIDS started with one guy arriving supposedly in Montreal, what they call patient zero, and within the couple of years, AIDS spread throughout the United States. So we're in a situation of a globalization and of a market system that isn't very fair. We're not going to talk about that, but part of globalization, one part of it that's sort of more positive that I wanted to focus on today is cultural globalization, the way in which we learn from each other, the cross-pollination of cultures. There's a way in which films from other countries can inspire us and inform us, and in the same way some of the better American films can do the same in other countries. Joining us in this half hour is a filmmaker who I've come to know and admire a great deal. Joanne Chung is an award-winning intercultural filmmaker and educator known for her documentary portraits of contemporary China. She's done China Gold Rush about on the orphans of Shangri-La, Golden Lotus about the legacy of bound feet, and Child about autistic challenges in China. She was born in Beijing. She was a TV journalist and anchorwoman in China Central Television, CCTV, before arriving in the U.S. in 1988. Before embarking on her independent filmmaking, she worked as an investigative reporter, a bilingual consultant, providing daring journalism and public relations for networks in the U.S., including ABC, MTV Asia, Discovery Channel, and PBS in the United States. She graduated from the University of Maryland and also in journalism from the Beijing Foreign Studies University. She's been teaching film aesthetics, directing, editing, documentary production at the New York Institute of Technology, and she's also an associate professor of cinema and television at the Beijing Normal University, United International College. She is living in Beijing, and she's visiting now in New York, and so I pressured her to come on this program because hers is a voice of the arts, of culture, who is very knowledgeable about our own country and her own country. She's a bridge, in a way, because of her language skills, because of her sensibility between the United States and China. Welcome, Joanne, to this program, News Dissector program on Progressive Radio Network. The number to call if you want to join the conversation is 888-874-4888. Joanne, tell us a little bit about your own sense of the cultural divide or the cultural unity between the United States and China.
Thank you, Danny, for having me. Good afternoon. I'm so blessed to be living in between these two great cultures. And I was born in China, but having been living in the United States for more than 20 years, I have the privilege to see China as an outsider while I'm also an insider. Right now, I just got back from China. What really amazed me is this cultural renaissance that's happening right now. And I feel China is finally on its track to finally wanting to show itself to the world culturally. You know, China in the past 30 years has been developing its economy, and it was really doing very great. For the next 30 years, China is determined to develop its culture or telling, perhaps to cultivate stories, if we talk about filmmaking, to tell the story in English, perhaps. And so China's government just launched a new cultural policy that is to take cultural industry to make it a national strategy. So it is no longer just industry, film industry on its own wanting to make money. It is a national strategy to develop China culturally.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, Kat, you know, and I went and saw this film, The Flowers of War, about the Japanese invasion of Nanking in China, where terrible atrocities were committed by the Japanese, rape. There's a book about the rape of Nanking. But this took one story. And actually, through that story, we saw all the issues there. It was made with very high production values. It was with great dramatic effect, with an American actor, with Chinese actors and actresses. And, you know, we saw it at the Sunshine Theater on Houston Street here in New York. You know, I would say with three-quarters of the audience were Chinese or Chinese-Americans who came to see it because, you know, in a way, it was a sign that Chinese film has arrived, not just kung fu movies, not just, you know, specifically, you know, kind of ethnographic films about China, but films that are popular, that can compete really in the same way that, you know, many Chinese films have won international awards and competitions and the like. So China is becoming, in addition to an economic power, a cinema power.
Sure. Director Zhang Yimou, I think, is the best-known director globally, and his new film, and I personally like it. And although it appeared to be a action plus melodrama, it is indeed his... I think it's a great work in terms of it's a combination of both art film and its commercial film. And I think perhaps some of the Western critics didn't really like it, and some of the Chinese critics didn't really like it. But it has been doing okay in China domestically. And how is it doing here in New York?
Well, I don't know. It was packed when we saw it, wasn't it? I mean, the Flowers of War.
Yeah, it was pretty crowded. Like you said, it was primarily Asian Americans that were there. I think we were kind of one of the few group of American Americans. But I literally had to keep myself in the seat because at a couple of points I really kind of wanted to run for the door because it was so hard to watch. But then... And, like, it would do a 180, and then the scene would just be complete beauty. So it really kind of took you on a bit of a roller coaster ride.
But also, it's about a part of our history that Americans really haven't been exposed to very much. And particularly at a time when China is being bashed by some media outlets in America. You know, China is making all the products. China has all the jobs. China, you know, kind of anti-China feeling we need to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. And all of this, China becomes sort of a new enemy. Here comes a film about pain in China, what China went through, how they struggled. You know, this current, you know, situation in China didn't happen by, you know, accident. It happened because the people of China really struggled against foreign invaders, against the opium wars, against all kinds of backwardness and underdevelopment to actually create, you know, a revolution. And yes, there are problems in China. Yes, there are conflicts. Yes, there are human rights issues. Yes, there are many, you know, gaps, if you will. In China, you have a growing gap of inequality like we have in our country. You know, at the same time, China is a great country, and it can't just be dismissed or defined in a mechanistic way, you know, kind of, you know, without understanding what China has contributed to the world and what it is contributing to the world. I mean, if China didn't exist, we would be in a deep depression right now. Let's face it, China has bought up the treasuries, has invested in America. Without that, you know, we would be, you know, our whole system has already collapsed. And China, in a way, is keeping it alive, which is an irony that communist China is saving capitalist America and the West, and that all the countries from, you know, Europe and elsewhere are going to China looking for trade deals, looking for help in various ways. But without getting, you know, too political here, because I promised you we wouldn't, let's talk a little bit about what it's like. You teach in a Chinese university, presumably, and do you teach in Chinese or English?
I'm teaching film in English at Beijing Foreign Studies University, School of English.
And what are your students like? What interests them? Do they watch a lot of American movies? Do they watch a lot of Chinese movies? What is it like to teach there?
I was still thinking about the director Zhang Yimou's movie because some of my students were talking about it. And I just want to go back to that, if you don't mind, about Chinese filmmaking in the new era, 21st century. So far, the co-production is the theme to go. And because I teach film, I teach not only the aesthetics of film, I also introduce the business aspect or the cultural interaction between United States and China. So the trend today is China still keep the 20 big films quota, which means not a lot of American film can go in except those 20 big film on the revenue shared basis. You can make co-production film, and so that China, as a big country, its image can be exported, meaning the U.S. company can distribute film. So therefore, this is cultural strategy as China goes out. So therefore, that's as a national strategy. So my students is learning that with me, and they're really interested in learning about this national global scene.
And the students there, how would you... You know, what's it like to be like a student with Chinese characteristics, you know? A student growing up in China, maybe their grandparents lived through the revolution or their you know, ancestors were part of the earlier dynasties in China. They have this long connection to this culture and this country, and yet they're thrust into this modern world of hyper-consumerism and the like. I mean, it was just a riot at a store in China, at an Apple store, you know, because they didn't have the 4S phones and people were really upset about it. You know, I mean, there's a way in which we're very similar and we're very different.
Mm-hmm. The Chinese students that I have is dominantly female, I teach at the China's best university in terms of language education. So they are very hip, actually, and they speak in English, and they actually think half in English, half Chinese. I see many of them are torn, actually, being not able to really think on American term, meaning I still want them to really learn the essence of the language. However, the Chinese cultural tradition is still there presenting as an obstacle.
Would you say that the Chinese tradition in some way is a we as opposed to an I? In other words, being part of a family, being part of a collective, being part of a community, not just thinking in terms of self-advancement.
It's very funny. If a student come to me and if I'm inside, my mother would ask, "Who are you?" The student would say, you know, in America, you would say, "I'm Susan" or "I'm Joanne," right? The student would say, "I am Cheng's teacher student," because they always introduce themselves in relation to other people. That means family or relationship come first, meaning if you really want to be a filmmaker, and this person has to consult the parents, if the parents really doesn't like it, then you actually, or this person is actually not be able to really carry on
a
position.
So there is a lot more respect for the for your elders,
right,
if you
right,
will, and for
right.
people in your family. Soo Min is here from South Korea. I promised not to talk to her, but I'm going to talk to her now because you're a film student in South Korea, another country, another culture. But does are some of the issues Joanne is raising something you can relate to about this conflict between being, you know, Korean and being here in America?
Could you explain more?
Well, I'm just saying this idea of your culture and the American culture. How do you see that?
usually Koreans, before they married, they don't leave their parents and they live together. But in the United States, they think they have some problems. So I was surprised about that. Yeah, and we have to respect elderly people. Yeah, and we have to just
like me.
Keep in mind. Yeah, keep in mind. Don't say a lot to elder.
Well, you know, I mean, these are, you know, America is changing, Joanna, from a kind of a white Anglo-Saxon culture to a much more multicultural society. You know, it may be that whites will be a minority in America in the next 50 years. You know, the growth of the Hispanic American, you know, is large, African Americans. You know, the dominant cultural theme of America in many ways is very mixed. In a sense, the conservative Christian right seems to want to go back to another time that's no longer with us. Kat, you had a thought?
Just really quickly, I just wanted to say maybe that's the why the, you know, the white man is kind of clamping down hard, you know. I mean, maybe he just sort of feels it, you know, like his time is up.
I mean, you know, we've had the situation of American troops urinating on the corpses of Afghans. This is, you know, outraging the world. It's the lack of, you know, kind of cultural respect for other people and other cultures. And this is a struggle here in America to try to make people more tolerant, more aware, more understanding of other cultural traditions. And somehow, if you can go to see other movies, you can, you know, these themes can be explored. And did you see the film Mao's Dancer?
Mm-hmm. What do you quite think a while
of,
ago.
A while ago. But this was a film about someone who is kind of in the Communist Party, chosen a dancer, ballet dancer, who ends up dancing with an American troop. And he's in a conflict with his government and with himself, within himself.
That's a base of very good story. Conflict, exploration of conflicts.
And is that encouraged in China? I mean, are Chinese filmmakers sort of feel pressure to tell the up story, the positive story of China?
That's such a good question. It's a big concern of me and many. I think in the Chinese film industry is now encouraging more stories. Actually, the film financing is really big right now, so it's not the money that's lacking. It's the innovation of storytelling. So basically, the China story is in great need of telling a contemporary story. China as a country or as a story source, it has 5,000 years of history, but it doesn't. We don't really have a lot of film that representing today's China, except Jia Zhang Ke is very good. He's a realist filmmaker. But director Zhang Yimou, he does a lot of historical films.
I saw a documentary called Appeal.
Of course, documentary is another genre.
Very powerful film of, you know, people who had grievances with the government, who came to protest in Beijing, and it was a gigantic community of people under the Chinese constitution. Apparently, you are allowed to protest, but it is an appeal, a decision. It doesn't.
You mean petition?
Yeah, petition rather. Yeah, that's what it's called. Or appeal, you know, and in many cases the government doesn't necessarily listen to the petitioners, but the fact that they're there and they take very seriously this constitutional provision that
but
gives people
rights. But
these
type of film would never show in China. Documentary seems to be an underground practice, but right now China is opening up a few documentary channel. But as to those kind of stories that revealing the perhaps the so-called darker side of China are not that popular on the Chinese television.
Is it because maybe China has a complex, you know, of inferiority in some way? They have to prove that they're as good as or better than.
Superiority.
Or superiority complex. Well, I mean,
I think it's a cultural issue. They really don't want to. I mean, the truth issue is a big issue. I mean, maybe it's apple polishing all the time. Talking about the sunny side, and my film usually deals with taboo subject matter, so I don't. That's why my film has so far not been shown in China. And it's been traveling around the world.
Well, just tell us, tell our audience about one of the films that I saw that you did about Bound Feet, which I thought was a very brave subject for you to take on. Tell people about what that phenomenon is, so that they know about it.
the film Golden Lotus, The Legacy of Bound Feet, and it was released in the International Film Circle. I'm going to show that film at Columbia University February 7th to talk about that.
At Barnard?
At Barnard, to a class, actually. This is my second time of doing so. I really think it's important to understand modern China through understanding its past, which this particular portion of history, that is, Chinese women's feet were bound, it has been a big taboo in China. But I want to deal with this issue from a different perspective, not treating women as a victim, but seeing them as a spiritual, free individual who has great strengths, who lives through oppression. So,
see, the characters in this film, and I saw this film, were just amazingly determined and proud women. They didn't see themselves as victims. They, you know, in some cases saw this as a, you know, a part of the legacy of a feudal past, you know, before the revolution and the like. But nevertheless, you know, they weren't ashamed to talk about it. They were very honest about it. And you brought that out in them, which I thought was, you know, very difficult subject to deal with. Which you did with great skill, I thought, you know, and again, the 5th of February at Barnard University, if you're interested.
But it's a private
screening. Screening. But yeah. How can people get your films?
I'm going to release it possibly in Amazon. And I have to
figure that out. Okay, but at least remember the name, Joanne Cheng, Cheng, C-H-E-N-G, filmmaker, and, you know, as you've heard on our program today, extremely eloquent, extremely sensitive, and able to discuss these issues with great, you know, charm and also a great insight. Thank you so much for being with us. We just want to take one more subject today. Kat has been covering Occupy Wall Street with us, and she's come up with a form, a police form, that is used in the stop and frisks in New York. You know, over 500,000 people, mostly people of color, are stopped and frisked by the police department in New York. Tell us about this form very quickly.
Well, I got it last week when Occupy was in front of Bloomberg's office residence, 59th and 79th Street and 5th Avenue, and one of the occupiers were handing it out. It's a stop, question, and frisk report worksheet from the NYPD, and it just has a list. What were circumstances which led to the stop? Must check at least one box, and the options are carrying objects in plain view, used in commission of crime, examples Slim Jim, pry bar, etc., fits description of, I guess, like another criminal, actions indicative of casing, victim or location, actions indicative of acting as a lookout, suspicious bulge object and describe in parentheses, and you know,
there's all these things that cops have to check out. In most instances, they don't have any necessary evidence that anybody's committed any crimes when before they stop and frisk them.
Yeah, where do you draw the line? I mean, it's like that all of these can be just completely blurred.
Yeah, well, this is an issue
to fit any one of us, you know.
Well, Occupy Wall Street has raised this issue. There have been arrests at precincts, including Cornel West. You know, the famous writer was arrested here in Harlem protesting against stop and frisk. This weekend, once again, the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King at the Riverside Church. There's going to be a big commemoration. What time is it again?
I believe they're meeting at the Riverside Church at 5:30, but then they're going to march to St. John of the Divine, which is supposedly the largest cathedral.
Yeah, that's at 110th.
And Masonic Cathedral, from what I learned.
No, Episcopal Cathedral. It's at 110th Street and Amsterdam. It's an important way to show your respect and support for Dr. King. It's called Occupy the Dream. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org if you have any comments on the program. There will be a podcast of this show available on my website at newsdissector.com. As soon as I get the information, I will post it up there, newsdissector.com. Please join us again next week at this time on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. So that's all from me right now. We're going to going to go out with the shorter version of Polarity One's new song, Occupy This, about the Occupy movement, Occupy Wall Street. Thank you to all at PRN for helping me bring you this show. Blast it, baby.